Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Hello and welcome to the Seminary Explores podcast. My name is Kristen Johnston-Largen and I am your host today. And I'm very excited to have with me as my guest, Dr. Greg Yethers, who is the Research Associate Professor in the Department of Biostatistics at the Graduate School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Kristen. It's my pleasure to be here, and I'm excited as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation. Well, for those who don't know, Greg is actually on our board, and you serve on the same subcommittee that I do. You chair it now. And so I've enjoyed getting to know you in that capacity, and I don't even remember when we started talking about your research. I think it was at a board dinner a couple meetings ago, and I found what you do really interesting. And given that we are in this year of kind of science and the seminary curriculum and thinking about kind of what that means and why science matters for people of faith, I thought it would be really fun to kind of hear your story as a person of faith and also talk then a little bit about your work and maybe how those things interface a little bit. So, yeah.
Very well.
Well, let's start out. Are you a lifelong Lutheran?
I am. I was born and baptized as an infant in the Lutheran Church. In Youngwood, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
At St. Luke's Lutheran Church.
Wow. And were you always active, or did you have a time when you were sort of less interested, or?
I don't think my family was particularly active when I was very young. My father used to race motocross,
which
was a Sunday activity.
And I bet for a boy, racing motocross was.
Very exciting, yes.
Right.
But, as it came time for me to be confirmed, my mother saw that we attended church regularly.
Okay.
And from that point on, probably, I don't know, age 10 or so, I've been very much involved in the Lutheran Church.
Yeah. And when you went off to college, were you able to, where'd you go to school? Were you able to kind of stay active in a church when you were doing that?
Well, I would say that was an important time for me. So I went to Penn State, and I was able to be employed as a camp counselor at Camp Lutherlin. That was probably one of the most formative things for my faith. It was at that time that I was kind of coming to realize that, yes, I had been born a Lutheran, but that wasn't good enough for me. And I began to explore my faith and eventually take ownership of it.
Yeah. Did you actually go to camp as a youth also then? Or
I did, but it wasn't a Lutheran camp. It was another church camp. I went for a couple of years.
So you became a camp counselor, just kind of part of you this ownership issue, feeling like you wanted to get more involved? Is that how that happened?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how many years were you a counselor?
Only 2 years, but you made a lot of great friends there.
Yeah.
I was on staff with Gil Waldkoning, one of our faculty here at Gettysburg.
So. Oh, isn't that great?
Yeah,
we really, I think that camping experience is a really important one. You know, I'm from Colorado, and we have a couple really strong Lutheran camps there, and boy, that it's a foundational experience. And I think it's like you said, it comes at a moment for people when they really are sort of switching to this is something that I've kind of passively maybe a little bit participated in, and now I really want to, you know, take ownership, like you said.
We had that discussion today at our board meeting about the summer camps being the minor leagues for the seminary,
right.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I think so too. And we're continuing to think about how we keep up that those contacts because, I think they're important. Well, when you went off to Penn State, did you know you wanted to be a scientist?
So I was kind of interested in physics, and my father steered me to engineering because he thought it was more tied to, like, a vocational path.
The fathers are concerned about the job, right? What are you going to do after you get this degree?
So I didn't do so well in engineering, and I ended up getting kicked out of the School of Engineering. And I kind of recovered by going into arts and sciences and getting a math degree from Penn State.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What was it about engineering? Did you just find it wasn't like the way you thought, or you kind of thought it was boring?
I think it was just maturity issues. I wasn't to the point of being a good student just yet.
Sure.
And I got my graduate degrees later in life, and I was a much better student at that time.
Oh, I didn't know. I don't remember talking about that part of the story. So you graduated with your math degree, and what did you do?
I worked as a quality assurance engineer for like 12 to 15 years.
Really?
And in my mid to late 30s, I went back to school at University of Pittsburgh, and I first got a master's in statistics. And some of the faculty really encouraged me to go on for a PhD, which wasn't my intent when I began.
Really?
And I looked for how could I do this. They offered me a stipend, but I already had a family, and I couldn't raise family on a stipend.
So sure.
I was able to get a full-time job at the University of Pittsburgh with the research group that I'm now a part of as a master's level statistician, and they would allow me to duck out for classes a couple times a week and work on my dissertation. So.
They must have really seen a lot of potential in you.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Well, that's fabulous. Yeah. So you finished, and then was it kind of always the plan that you would sort of just stay there in a new capacity?
Well, that wasn't the expectation when I began, but I think they recognized some talent in me, and yes, they kind of asked me to stay on once I got my PhD, and it's worked out very well.
So tell me about the work that you do there.
So I'm a research associate professor, meaning that I'm not primarily involved in teaching.
Sure.
And I'm more in research. And my research group is called the NRG Oncology Clinical Trials Cooperative Group. And we conduct, my focus is clinical trials in colon and rectal cancer.
Okay.
And so I design trials of experimental agents, usually drugs.
Okay.
Could be other interventions like radiation or a different surgery, for example. And then we conduct trials, and then I analyze the trials. So.
Okay. So when you say you design the trial, does that mean you kind of set the parameters for it? So we'll have this many people, this many will get the treatment, this many will have a placebo, this is how long it will go,
all of those parameters, but you kind of come at it from how big of an effect do you think this drug will have?
And what data do you have that you can even start with to make a decision like
So, in some cases, you know the drug shows promise, but you may not have any idea how big the effect is.
Okay.
But you say, well, if the effect is not at least this big, it wouldn't be so clinically interesting.
Okay.
You wouldn't want to change practice.
Sure. Okay.
So you identify a kind of clinically interesting threshold of effect, and you say, okay, if the effect were that big, how many patients would I have to study in order to see that, say, 90% of the time? And that 90% of the time is what you call the power of a statistical test. So you have a type 1 error, which is the chance that there is no effect, and you make an incorrect conclusion.
Okay.
So that's the type 1 error, or alpha. Usually it's 5% in clinical research. And the power is, if the effect is as big as I think it is, then what's the chance I'll have a positive study at the end? And we usually set that at 80% or 90%.
So do I hear you saying that you, before you would actually go through, or somebody would give the approval to go ahead and go through with the study, you have to be able to show that there's going to be 80% of the people are going to be positively affected? Or how do you, I'm fascinated.
Okay. No, so the trial would have an 80% chance of a positive outcome.
And what's a positive outcome?
You prove it's better than the treatment you're testing it against.
And that's only 51% of the people do better, or...
Well, so here's the thing. For something like ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a non-invasive breast cancer.
Okay, all right.
They have 97% survival at 10 years.
Okay, nice.
All right? So almost everybody does just fine.
Yep.
So an effective treatment would reduce the death rate by half. So instead of 97% survival at 10 years, it's 98.5%.
Okay.
So
okay.
Here's the thing, though. Now, you have to treat 100 people for one and a half to benefit, or you have to treat 200 people
right.
for
sure.
three to benefit.
Right, right.
So that's called like the number needed to treat.
Okay.
And that can be, if, well, it's easier, you can do a trial with many fewer patients if most of them have adverse outcomes and you only need to.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. Right.
Most of them don't have adverse outcomes, then it usually takes a lot more patience.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, how it would seem like for and again, right, you're working with an amateur here, Greg. That there at some point, or maybe with some drugs, you would get into the moral question of, if you know that a drug is really likely to help, how can you justify in this trial not giving it to everybody?
All right. Well, so we have a philosophical term we call equipoise.
Equipoise.
Okay. Equipoise. And equipoise is where I don't really know that this drug's going to help.
Okay.
I know that it kills cancer cells in a test tube.
Okay.
I know that it shrinks tumors that we implant in mice.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it's going to help people.
Okay.
So there's some reason to believe it should be promising,
okay.
but I don't know that it's going to help people. And at least philosophically, you only conduct a trial when equipoise exists.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
And when, even during the conduct of a trial, if sufficient evidence starts to mount where you no longer have equipoise, then you have an ethical issue of whether you continue the trial or you stop it and report it early.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, and then what about situations? I was just reading something. I think it might have been in Time Magazine, actually, when I was at the gym, and it was talking about experimental trials, right? And people who have either some rare form of cancer or something, and they've tried more traditional treatments and it's not working. Apparently, there's a database where you can actually go online and see all of the experimental trials that are going on. Is that true? Am I making that up?
That's not that something that I work in.
Okay,
but I believe such a thing exists.
Well, I was just so when the case would seem to be dire, it would seem like, so you're talking about equipoise. So on the one hand, you could have a situation where, oh gosh, it looks like people are really helped, so we want to, or you could have a situation where we're like, well, we're not confident this drug is really going to do anything, but it's better than, we want to at least give it a shot. I mean, can you have sort of not equipoise that way either, or is that always sort of worth?
So we kind of have different phases of clinical trials. And a phase one clinical trial would be first in humans.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Right.
And
so you've tried it in mice.
Those are usually for people who are otherwise in bad shape, terminal people.
Okay.
And so there's some chance this drug may help them, but that's not really why we're giving it to them. We're really giving it to them to see if people can tolerate it.
Okay.
And
that's a phase one trial.
That's a phase one trial.
Okay.
And then once you pass a phase one trial, you can see it can be safely given to humans. Generally, you have a phase two trial, which is usually a small trial to kind of proof of principle. See that, instead of improving survival, you might show that the tumors tend to shrink.
Oh, okay.
With the drug. So that's not enough for me to prescribe it to you.
Okay.
Some tumors shrink.
Okay.
But it's some indication that it's likely to work in people.
Okay.
And if you have a positive phase two trial, then you would do a definitive phase three trial, which is usually the evidence that the FDA would act on to give an indication for a new treatment.
How long is it from phase one to phase three to FDA approval?
Oh, my goodness. Well, so there can be quite a bit of drug development before you ever get to phase one.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Laboratory testing and animal testing that comes before that.
Sure.
To go from the beginning of phase one to the end of a phase three trial, in cancer at least, would probably take 10 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And are you here at every stage of the way, or do you just work primarily with phase one or primarily with phase three, or are you involved from start to finish with a new drug?
No. So we kind of specialize in phase three clinical trials.
Okay.
We're doing more phase two
Okay.
Recently, and I am familiar with Phase 1 trials, but I don't have a great deal of experience with them.
Okay, okay. And so one of the other things that I think we had actually talked about before that I wanted to ask you about again was you mentioned colorectal cancer is your area of expertise. But I'm hearing more that cancers are not being identified with parts of the body as much as they are with the type of cancer that they are.
That's
right. Are you experiencing that also in your research?
You know, since we've had the human genotype and it's amazing. We can do your whole genome in a matter of a couple of days for $1,000 now. So the genetic revolution is upon us. And so historically, cancers were kind of classified according to anatomy.
Sure,
so
which makes sense.
Cancer,
right, yeah,
cancer,
sure.
Right. But now in the genomic era, that maybe doesn't make as much sense.
Okay.
So you could have cancers that arise from a mutation of a particular gene, and one happens to seed and develop in the colon, another one in the lung. Well, they may be more similar because they're arising from the same genetic mutation, even if they are in different parts of the anatomy. So I expect that we will move more and more towards that, and there'll be less and less importance placed on the anatomical location of the cancer.
But still, heretofore,
The
kind of work that you do, you can still say it's colorectal cancer. I mean, that's that in terms of your own area
it
of
is.
Focus.
And, you know, the regulatory bodies, they have a lot of inertia, and so it will be some time before they will be approving drugs based on genetic similarity.
So right now, drugs are based on an anatomical location.
They are.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Okay, I want to ask you a question that you're not going to expect, and then I want to ask you about if and how your faith sort of informs this work that you're doing. But the question I want to ask you that we hadn't talked about, so I know it's going to come a little bit of a surprise, I want to ask you about animal testing. How you feel about animal testing, if you actually engage in animal testing, if it's an issue for you in any way, how that sort of works.
So I haven't been directly involved in animal testing.
Okay, because that all comes before it comes to you, obviously, right?
It does.
Okay.
I don't know that I've thought this through.
I knew that's why I was surprised.
My first blush would be that God gave us dominion over the birds of the air and the plants and the animals. And, you know, if we can relieve human suffering by limited testing in animals, then it's for the greater good.
Okay. I've heard that, for me, so, you don't know a lot about my theology, but I feel a little differently about that and about the Dominion verse, which is fine. But just in terms of even practically, I've heard the arguments that why would we assume that because a drug can treat a tumor in a mouse that it would function in the same way? I mean, there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And I'm also wondering about the possibility of using computer models. I'm hearing, again, right, this is totally kind of anecdotal in some ways, that technology is becoming more sophisticated, and maybe at some point we would get to a place where we wouldn't need animals anymore.
Yeah, the computer modeling is only as good as the assumptions.
Okay.
And there's really no way to verify that all of your assumptions are correct. So it's really a leap of faith. I mean, I would think it would make sense to do that work before you would do work in animals.
Oh, I see.
No sense.
Yep.
Putting animals through anything unless you have reason to believe the drug should be effective.
Right.
There is kind of a new model that they're using with animals. So, you know, it is one thing to kind of infect the mouse with the disease and then see if the treatment works on them. Although, you know, the immune system of a mouse is really quite similar to that of a human.
Is it really?
but a new thing that they're doing is they're able to take a human cancer and kind of implant it and create a hybrid where the tumor is really a human tumor and a mass of living human cells, and the mouse really just acts as a host.
Oh, okay.
And so there's more reason to believe in that model that if the treatment is effective, that it would be effective in humans.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's very interesting. Well, yeah, I think about this a lot for me. This is kind of an issue. But, yeah, and I think it's it raises a lot of good theological questions. And, I've given the area of your work, I can understand your interpretation of it that way. That makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Well, before we finish, and again, we're almost to the end of our time, I wanted to ask you about your faith. Obviously, has continued to grow and deepen in this work. And do they feel like separate spheres of your life, or do they feel like kind of a holistic Greg, as you're the person of faith and the scientist?
No. I really feel like this is a way that I could be employed and help society. And I'm grateful for that. And I know not everyone can be as fulfilled in their work as I am.
Yeah, right.
So it's quite a blessing to me to be able to do this work. And, on the side, I like to think of myself as an amateur minister. I don't get paid to do the ministry, but I do that sort of work on the side. I'm active in my local church, and I'm active here on the board at Gettysburg.
Yeah, of course. I think that's great. Well, one of the things that I think is really important to share with people broadly, of course, we always talk about the need of congregations to raise up leaders in the church when we're thinking about professional ministers. But like you said, I mean, there are people who have a sense of vocation and really feel that you're doing the work God has called you to do for the sake of the world, right? I think that's important for people to know that there are different ways of doing that, and public ministry is one way of doing that. But there are many occupations that people can sort of experience their vocation and in really meaningful ways. And I think it's good for, younger people to have that sense, because I think you're right when you see it that way. Of course, it's going to deepen your participation in a congregational life and that kind of work, because you see how they go together, which I think is really important. You're right. I think there are a lot of people who what they do Monday through Friday, they don't really experience with a connection, with what they do on Sunday. And so that you're able to sort of see those things together, I think, is really a gift.
Yes. Yeah.
Super. Well, Greg, delight to talk with you, and thank you for the conversation, and I will look forward to seeing you again the next time our board meets.
Yes, it's been my pleasure. Great talking with you today, Kristen.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from Historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.